protection for the environment, the arts, the craft movement, the dignity of labour against the ravages of capitalism in the industrial age and the perils of pollution were just some of the issues and causes that John Ruskin championed. And then there was his art, architecture, writing, public lectures, so much to go through with our guest, Howard Hull. Howard, happy birthday.
Well, I'm going to need a lot of puff to blow out those 200 candles, but yeah, indeed.
But you'll be blowing a lot of candles, won't you, because there will be celebrations, exhibitions all across Britain.
Indeed, yes, all across Britain. At the Royal Academy tomorrow night, 200 years on from his birth, and all over the world, in fact, exhibitions in Japan, in America, in Italy, and of course here in Britain.
I recall Kenneth Clarke at his snootiest writing that no other writer perhaps has suffered so great a fall in reputation as Ruskin. But in 2019, there's very renewed interest, isn't there? Something of a Ruskin revival.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It seems like his time has come. Time has come for his ideas. I think, 19 years ago, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of his death, and it was all about the biography. It was all about Ruskin's marriage. It was about his difficulties in his personal life and so on, and we struggled to get his ideas out there. But this time round, people seem to really want to know what he thought and why it's relevant to us today.
How were you first attracted to him?
I was attracted as a teenager. I was interested in art. I wanted to be a great artist. I was ambitious for that. And it was the 1960s. I saw a book with a very psychedelic cover on it called Ruskin Today. And it was a selection of Ruskin's writings. I bought it really because of the cover. I wanted to be seen at school carrying around something colorful and looked like a sort of Andy Warhol portrait of Ruskin. Then I opened it up and said, "Characteristics of a Great Painter." And I thought, yes, that's me. So I read it. I thought it was fantastic. And then I tried to read some more of Ruskin and discovered that it wasn't quite so easy at that age. So the book sort of sat there like a sort of totem for me, but I have to say that I didn't go on to become a great painter, but I did eventually reconnect with Ruskin and he became an important part of my life.
Howard, there's still plenty of time.
Yes, I hope.
And talking about great painters, I first became aware of Ruskin and grateful to him because of his advocacy for my favourite painter in Turner.
Yes, absolutely. And he was my favourite painter as well. I would spend school holidays to go up to the Tate and sit in front of the Turners there. And then, of course, Ruskin, from the age of 13 himself, was besotted with Turner. And in many respects, the course of his life was mapped out for him with that relationship with Turner.
I didn't realise that he finished up as Turner's executor.
Yes, he didn't really want to be Turner's executor, but in a sense there was nobody better equipped to do it, because of course Turner left his entire collection of unsold paintings to the nation, and it's a formidable amount of collection. And Ruskin was invited by the National Gallery to go through it all, to annotate it and to understand it. And there was really nobody who knew what Turner had been up to more than Ruskin and could understand what he was looking at. So he was very important to that.
I've got a tiny Turner. It's a preparatory sketch for View from Orvieto. I remember being absolutely astonished when, just a couple of years ago, Rome from Mount Aventine sold at auction for over 30 million smackers, which is the highest price for any British-born artist.
Yes, and Turner is a truly internationally important artist. British artists have, particularly in the landscape tradition, other than Constable, have struggled in a way on the international stage. In competition, one might say, with the great painters of the Renaissance and so forth, or the Impressionists. But Turner has certainly stood out there for British landscape painting.
Well, let's move from his soaring talent to soaring architecture. Ruskin, of course, loved the Gothic.
He did. Ruskin discovered the Gothic actually when he was on his first journey to discover Turner, to explore Turner's landscapes in Europe, because he had been given a travel book or travel poem which was illustrated by Turner, called Italy by the poet Rogers. And he went off into Europe, and as he went through both northern France, the great Gothic cathedrals, but then ultimately to land in the city of Venice, he discovered the true soul, if you like, of Gothic, which was deeply important to Ruskin, both in terms of its aesthetic, but ultimately in terms of his social ideas as well.
Well, let me just mention some of these. He praises the Gothic for what he sees as its reverence for nature, natural forms, the free, unfettered expression of artisans constructing and decorating buildings. He saw the organic relationship between worker and guild and community and natural environment, and indeed with God.
You put it very well. I mean, I think the thing that Ruskin saw was that the Industrial Revolution and mass production had in effect brought the power of science and technology together with classicism and the idea of the ideal and the, in a sense, a sort of definition of work as something which conformed to a very fixed idea of things. In other words, it was against failure, it was against exploration, and it was ultimately against nature. So he passionately believed that the Gothic was something which released the sort of power of the human spirit, and that industrialization was something which denied it.
Howard, I want you to blow out a couple of candles you didn't quite finish off over there while I reintroduce you to the audience. Howard, who's huffing and puffing, is Howard Hull, director of the Ruskin Foundation and the Brentwood Trust. It's Ruskin's former home in the Lake District, which now operates as a quite marvellous museum. And this, of course, is LNL on RN. Now, the 1850s, he takes up what we would call today social justice issues, and his lectures are popular and well-attended. Tell us of some of the topics and issues he raised.
Right. Well, Ruskin was concerned about the division of labour as being something which also produced it, what for him was the division of the individual between the human spirit, the human soul, one might say, and their body. In other words, industrialization, as he saw it in a laissez-faire capitalist society of the 1840s, 1850s, was something which caused the worker to force the worker, indeed, to leave behind a part of their person, the essential part, as from his point of view, that is to say, their spirit, their imagination, their soul, and to become, in effect, like the machines that they were operating. And he believed passionately, indeed, he begins his great argument in Unto This Last about the political economy with a view of the idea that if you take the soul out of a worker while they're at work and then expect it to be put back in when they finish their work, eventually, rather like a sort of chemist in the laboratory, you've taken out an ingredient which, when it's put back in, will become explosive. And so he was writing at a time when there was great fear of the revolution, as it were, of the workers in society, and he believed that it was a potentially revolutionary mix. So that he argued very strongly about the nature of work. He argued about social conditions of the worker, that work must not only be fulfilling to the individual, but also, of course, to produce products that were of value to the consumer. But he also believed strongly that the laborer should be paid fairly. He believed in a minimum wage. It took Britain just short of 100 years to
No wonder he was so unpopular in some sectors of the upper echelon.
Yes, and he was, and in fact, the essays which he was writing for the Cornhill magazine, the editor, Thackeray, actually terminated the series in advance and told Ruskin to finish the thing off all in one sort of final essay. So in effect, his ideas were censored at the time.
I mentioned that he was a polymath. The lectures covered things like art history, geology, architecture, myth, ornithology, literature, education, botany, political economy, and the role of women. Now, in 1864, Dad dies, leaving a considerable estate. What did Ruskin do with the dosh?
Right, well, I mean, he immediately put it to work. Main thing that he, the most expensive thing, the single thing that he did was to create a college in Oxford, the Oxford School of Drawing and Fine Art, and to endow it not just with finance, but also with a tremendous collection, a teaching collection of paintings and fine art objects and so forth that were relevant to illustrating his ideas about art. He also founded a guild called the Guild of St. George, which still goes today. The idea of the guild was, in one sense, very simple. It was to bring together like-minded individuals to make Britain a better place. What did that consist of? It consisted of purchasing land in order to establish farms with fair rents and to give people an opportunity to return to the countryside in a constructive, artisan sort of way.
Sorry to interrupt, but you can see why Tolstoy found him inspirational.
Yeah, very much so. Because, in fact, Tolstoy's own experiments in exactly the same thing on his estate at Yasnaya Polyana were about doing really very much what the Guild also had set out to do.
And we should also factor in that Gandhi was a fan.
Yes, and I think it's one of the powers of Ruskin's thinking that it could translate across such different cultures. Gandhi was a legal clerk in South Africa, in fact, in his youth, and his brother gave him a copy of Ruskin's tract on the political economy until this last. And Gandhi read it on a train going north to Durban. When he got off the train, he said it altered the course of his life, directed the course of his life, and he translated it into Gujarati. It's still on sale in Gandhi's translation, and based many of the precepts of his revolution on Ruskin's thinking.
And I understand that early Labour Party MPs in the UK found Ruskin inspirational.
Yes, because although Ruskin called himself at the beginning of his autobiography a Tory of the old school, in fact he was deeply influential on the founders of the early welfare state in British life. And in 1919, 100 years ago, when the Royal Academy sought to celebrate Ruskin's centenary of his birth, George Bernard Shaw got up and made a speech, and he said, "I've known many revolutionaries in my time, and when I've asked them, what set you on the road to revolution? Was it Marx? Was it Lenin? They've said, no, it was Ruskin."
I wonder if Jeremy Corbyn reads Ruskin.
I don't know. I haven't seen it poking out of his pocket.
No, one lives in hope. I forgot the Pre-Raphaelites. We should give them a mention in dispatches.
We should. Ruskin's interest in art is very eclectic. It goes because the Pre-Raphaelites, in many ways, couldn't be more different from Turner. But at another level, they answered very strongly to something that Ruskin felt deeply, which was that nature was the great teacher, and that you needed to go to nature in humbleness and report on what you saw with fidelity and accuracy. And he felt particularly that he inspired the Pre-Raphaelites to abandon what was considered to be a sort of degraded sort of artistic language, and to look closely at the truth of nature. and to represent it. And so he became a central figure for the Pre-Raphaelites.
But you're quite right. It's almost the antithesis of what Turner was doing.
It is. I mean, Ruskin's writing about art is really interesting because it's capable of actually putting its finger on elements of the essential aspects of the creative process, which are quite different, turn out quite differently in practice for different artists. I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright was influenced by Ruskin.
I didn't know that.
Yes, deeply so. I mean, it's a very and so was Sullivan, the great American skyscraper architect. So Ruskin's ideas had this ability to find what I would call universal values, which were at the heart of the sort of creative process, and therefore could ring true for practitioners who really were very, very different from one another.
I hate to invade his privacy, but we must talk a little about his private life, which had its torments.
Yes. Yes, and they've tended to dominate people's view of Ruskin over the century. Ruskin was unhappily married. He was married quite young, but his bride was younger. She, Effie Gray, she was a distant cousin, and the marriage was in many respects an arranged marriage, not just from Ruskin's parents' side, but actually from her own father's side. Her father was just about to go bankrupt and was in a desperate state, and needed his daughter to marry well, and so. She and Ruskin had really quite a sort of, not quite a forced marriage, but it was certainly a rushed marriage. The parents didn't attend, for instance, Ruskin's own parents. And it got off to an unhappy start. As a result, one never knows the inner parts and doesn't really want to know the inner sort of aspects of the bridal night. But anyway, the marriage was not consummated. Eventually, after 5 years, the marriage was dissolved on the grounds of incurable impotence. There are all sorts of theories about this, which I'm not going to go into.
And then, because we don't have a lot of time, a little later he falls in love with a 10-year-old girl.
He does.
Waits till she's 18 to propose.
Yeah.
But the marriage never happened.
No, Rose herself was unstable. She was deeply conflicted and, she was poorly. She blew hot and cold with Ruskin through this period. She wouldn't, in a sense, reject him totally, but she wouldn't accept him either. She asked him to wait until she was 21, which he did, whether or not they would get married. In the end, they didn't, and at the age of 27, she died of, we think, anorexia, but certainly she had tremendous sort of problems, and of course Ruskin himself had problems. So,
well, then of course he lapses into dementia, mm-hmm. and tragically dies a broken man in 1900, just as the century he'd done so much to shape was receding from view.
Yes, yeah. I mean, he's actually more productive in the later years, perhaps, than he's given credit for. It's just that the work is more difficult to read, and the great sort of famous works, Modern Painters, Unto This Lust, etc., are out there, and that's what his fame is rightly built upon. But yes, the end of Ruskin's life is almost a sort of King Lear figure, right? It's a Shakespearean tragedy being enacted in relation to his personal life. And the last 10 years of his life, we know that he suffered from mental breakdowns and possibly some strokes, and he was unable to write. So the last 10 years of his life, really, relatively speaking, are quiet.
It's you can see why he's being rediscovered, apart from your own excellent efforts, Howard. And that is, his prescience is astonishing, and so many of the issues that concerned him now concern a lot of young people.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the top ones of those is climate change. Ruskin wrote, one of the last works that Ruskin wrote, is called The Storm Cloud of the 19th Century. And it is a remarkable piece about the changes in climate that he observes. Ruskin was a keen observer of climate his entire life. So it's based on some very definite scientific sort of observation of the environment. At the same time, he's absolutely convinced that it reflects human agency and also the human spirit. And I think that he speaks very powerfully to young people today in terms of their concerns about the way that we have lost our connection to the natural world and our respect for it and the way in which we are endangering everything.
I'm just looking at a list here of things that he championed. I mean, meant much of the welfare state. He was an inspiration for the founders of the National Health Service, for the formation of public libraries, indeed for the National Trust. But we're out of time, and I thank you very much, Howard, for coming on our little program.
Good. I hope you'll blow the last of those candles out.
Well. And we'll share the gluten-free cake with all the listeners. Howard Hull, the director of the Ruskin Foundation and the Brantwood Trust.